Morning.
Morning. May it please the court. Again, my name is Nicholas Stern, and I represent James Goldstein, Executive Officer of the California Air Resources Board. I'd like to make 2 points today. I'd like to show how the district court erred by finding that the VESTA rules are preempted emission standards rather than valid in-use regulations. Secondly, I'd like to show how the Submerged Lands Act does not preclude California from regulating emissions from more than 3 miles. The VESTA rules could have been drafted as pure fuel switching requirements. They would have been very easy to analyze and if they had done that. Applying the test in the Supreme Court's test in EMA versus South Coast, such a pure fuel switching regulation would clearly not have set a maximum definite limit. Such a fuel regulation would not have required any addition of an additional emission control device, and such a regulation would not require any other design feature related to the control of emissions.
That's not what they did.
That's not what they did. What they did was they added flexibility for the sake of vessel operators so that they could comply by alternative means of compliance.
Well, what they did was they didn't say you have to use this kind of fuel. What they said is you can't emit X amount of level.
That is effectively the same thing. Those limits that you're referring to only come into play if the vessel operator intends to use one of the alternative means of compliance.
So would you concede that without the provision for alternative switching to cleaner diesel fuel from bunker oil or whatever it is that they're using in these engines, that if we just had before us the measurement, which essentially, as I understand it, is determined by the measuring the particulate matter that comes out of the engine, that would be an emission regulation standing alone, would it not?
If what you're saying, Judge Tolman, is that if you eliminate subsection C of the regulation, the presumption, I would have to answer no, because it still would be true that by using the compliant fuel, the operator is necessarily in compliance.
Forget about the compliant fuel. Let's suppose that the Air Resources Board had done nothing more than promulgate a regulation saying, we think that marine diesel engines are creating too much air pollution in and about the coast of California. And we hereby promulgate these regulations that say that these engines shall not emit particulate matter beyond these levels. Those would be pure emission standards, would they not?
That would be, I do admit that would be a closer call. The problem there is that under the EMA versus South Coast test, it requires an emission standard is one that is a definite, certain, fixed number.
Well, why isn't, if I read this, I'm looking at the marine vessel rules, and I just kind of truncated it a little bit. It says, you know, they can't exceed, and then they say emission rates if you use specified fuels, and then with the specific sulfur content. That is basically a descriptive way of giving an emission level, is it not? Isn't it an emission standard?
Judge McEwen, again, those emission levels only come into play, though, if they don't comply by switching fuels.
But let's go back. So just the language I read in terms of how it's defined, the emission rates and then subject to fuel and the specific sulfur, I guess that's sulfur content.
Yes.
Standing alone, is that an emission standard?
The emission standard, it is not an emission standard because any engine can comply regardless of its emission characteristics. If an engine is using the compliant fuel, it doesn't matter what the level of emissions are.
But the problem
the problem is that you're now switching. You're switching back to the alternative.
And the only way you have of determining whether or not the switch to the alternative fuel is acceptable is through an emission standard, because that's the only test you have in order to know whether or not you've improved the emissions from the engine and reduced pollution.
If I may, Judge Tolman, I could compare it to EPA regulations that they have approved as in-use regulations that have similar characteristics.
So your position is this is no different from forcing us to buy biodiesel fuel at the pump for our car?
That's right, although this is, since it's a non-road source,
right.
Different
that,
conditions.
That's different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, I do think that the key to the points that Judges McKeown and Judge Tolman are making is the answer is in Ray, because Ray says that even if there is an alternative that is permitted, that saves an otherwise preempted regulation.
But the problem in Ray was that we're trying to get around the double hull requirement, and the way that you do it is you hire an escort tug, and then you can bring your single hull tanker in Puget Sound, because if things go awry, you've got a tugboat that can prevent the tanker from going on the rocks.
Exactly.
But since you've now taken us geographically to the Pacific Northwest, let me ask you a geographical question. California wants to regulate vessels 24 miles out into the waters of the Pacific. I live in a state where we have vessels that transit Puget Sound that may be bound for ports in Vancouver, British Columbia. They may be bound for the ports of Tacoma or the ports of Seattle on the southern edge of Washington. I've got vessels coming up and down the Columbia River that may be going to Oregon ports of call, or they may be going to Washington ports of call. If we rule in your favor, what's to prevent the legislatures of Oregon and Washington, or British Columbia for that matter, from promulgating regulations that are different and which may require both domestic and foreign flag vessels that call on all these ports, including California ports, from having to comply with multiple regulations that may specify different levels or in-use regulations that are going to be inconsistent? And isn't that the whole purpose behind federal preemption, in order to promote uniformity, particularly in a traditional area, maritime commerce, going back to the founding days of the Republic, which has always been within the purview of the federal government?
Well, Judge Tolman, you've got me thinking about two different things. First of all,
answer them in any order. That's what's bothering me.
I'll do my best.
Okay.
Getting to the second one, while maritime commerce is a traditional federal area, what we're dealing with is a claim of Clean Air Act preemption. And air pollution is an area of traditional historic state concern. So I don't think it's, I think, for instance, in the recent case of UFO shooting, there would have been, that case would have been preempted because it was a regulation of maritime interest.
And what saved it?
What saved it was that, first of all, the presumption against preemption applied, and
Congress passed a specific provision in the Budget Reconciliation Act which gave Hawaii the authority to intrude into an otherwise historical federal maritime area in order to preserve humpback whale mating grounds.
The Congress's the legislation in that case, though, did not address regulation of licenses, Coast Guard licenses.
Well, the argument was that by virtue of the fact that the Coast Guard had regulated licensing, that these whale restrictions, if I can call them that, on the operation of vessels off the coast of Maui would somehow impinging upon traditional maritime authority. And the answer to that question is, even if it did, Congress has said that's okay. The problem you've got here is that California didn't get the permission of the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency before it began enforcing these regulations.
Well, Judge Solomon, a couple of notes there. First of all, Congress did allow states to adopt in-use regulations. And I think the interpretation that PMSA is asserting would actually wipe out Section 209D's application here.
Let's go back, though. When you started with in-use, and we're kind of getting back to this. What is your position as to whether what we're talking about is actually a fuel requirement? Is it or is it not a fuel requirement?
Certainly, it's a flexible fuel requirement. Like a lot of regulations, it requires one thing, but it allows optional methods to comply.
But if I looked at your materials prior to the brief, it seems to me that you say there that the regulations do not even require ship owners to use certain fuels. It's not a fuel requirement or a switching requirement, at least in the materials as you described them leading up to this regulation. But now in the brief, you're saying it's a fuel requirement.
In the, forgive me, Your Honor, but in the administrative materials that CARB submitted, it says throughout those materials that this is a fuel requirement, but that there are many options. It's flexible.
Now, if I understand correctly, these rules apply not just to vessels that are docked at a port in California, but in addition to vessels that are 24 miles out into the ocean. Is that right?
That's
By
right.
What right does California regulate those waters out there?
Well, the PMSA argues that they're precluded from doing that by field preemption of the Submerged Lands Act, but the Submerged Lands Act has nothing to do with that. The cases of Barber, Gillis, and Warner versus Dunlop all rejected claims of field preemption based on the Submerged Lands Act. So that's why instead, CARB suggests that the court look to the effects test, which is a test that has been applied for almost 100 years, beginning with Strassheim versus Daley by the Supreme Court. And it sets forth that states can regulate can adopt reasonable regulations of extraterritorial conduct.
So can you help me again with my Pacific Northwest geographical example? Aren't the states of Oregon, Washington, and the province of British Columbia going to have exactly the same concerns?
Thank you for bringing me back to that.
Okay.
Actually, I think that if Congress had wanted uniformity in the area of fuel regulations, it would have, when it amended the Clean Air Act in 1990, it would have amended Section 211 as well. The 211 is the regulation, the statute about fuels. It could very easily have added a preemption of fuel regulations to that. It chose not to. Therefore, there's no indication that Congress, unlike when it comes to manufacturing, there's no indication that Congress has an interest in preserving the uniformity of fuel regulations.
But if we disagree with your characterization that these are in-use fuel regulations, and decide instead that what they really are emission levels, then we do have a uniformity problem, do we not? Because then if we allow California to do it, there's nothing to prevent Oregon, Washington, and the province of British Columbia from doing the same thing, but picking different emission level standards than what California has done.
Again, I think you cannot assume that Congress intended uniformity. The Supreme Court in Askew, for instance, said that federal admiralty law does not swallow the state's police power. The court in Ray said that vessels need to comply with reasonable environmental protection measures.
But your argument taken to its logical conclusion has to be that those legislatures have the same authority that California does under the effects test to issue these kinds of regulations.
Absolutely,
even
they could. I'm saying that Congress didn't see a problem with that. Congress, this is not an area where Congress demanded uniformity, unlike vessel design.
As long as it's an in-use or an approved circumstance, right?
Yes.
Okay, so if you get to in-use, here's where I'm having some trouble, maybe you can help me out. When you look at the statute and you think about the Ray case, you know, for example, the tugboat pulling, you know, piloting the ship into Puget Sound or whatever, that's one that seems to me you could say, well, that relates to the operation of the vessel within the waters of the state of Washington. Cities that impose, you know, no driving days or carpool lanes and things like that, those are the typical in-use provisions that are usually exemplary. How does this regulation fit into the in-use statutory definition?
Judge McKeown, for one thing, the EMA versus CPA case cited legislative history where the, I think they were the congressional managers, said, as an example, that sulfur limits on fuel are a type of in-use regulation.
That's a sulfur limit on fuel. This is an emissions.
This is an emissions
standard.
Well,
a fuel requirement in effect? Single fuel requirement?
Yes, this is a fuel requirement.
A sulfur limit on a specific fuel?
Yes, my position, CARB's position is this is essentially, it's a fuel requirement that allows options, that allows flexibility so that vessel operators can comply in other ways.
Well, but for example, if you said you have to use fuel X, okay, is that an in-use requirement?
Yes.
Okay. Because while it might, by the back door, be an emission requirement because it obviously maybe has a certain characteristic, but it's a fuel requirement, correct?
Yes.
It's not an emission standard.
That's correct, John.
And you would like to have us treat this regulation as following exactly that kind of a fuel requirement situation, correct?
Exactly, Your Honor. The EPA approved, if I may speak to Texas's lawn regulations, there they used, Texas had adopted a traditional in-use regulation, hours of use restrictions for landscaping equipment. However, in Texas's rule, they allowed landscapers to submit alternative plans to achieve the same level of emission reductions so that they could continue to landscape during the morning hours. The EPA held that that was still, or not held, ruled that that was still a valid in-use regulation.
But you didn't have, I guess the problem I had there is that the alternatives really weren't the issue because there was no preemption to begin with. And we're looking here as to whether there's preemption. So it's not exactly a parallel situation as I saw it.
Judge McKeown, effectively it is though. Effectively, what you're starting with is a fuel regulation. And then, just like in the Texas case, you are adding these alternatives.
Why don't you answer Judge McHugh's question, then we're going to turn it over to Ms. Baird. Yeah,
but if there's a preemption, then the analysis would be different, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Barbara Baird, representing today the South Coast Air Quality Management District, Natural Resources Defense Council, and Coalition for Clean Air. I'd like to remind the Court that the District Court actually agreed that fuel sulfur requirements are not preempted. That being the case, under the precedent that the U.S. Supreme Court set forth in Ray versus Atlantic Richfield, this Court should hold that the vessel rules as a whole are not preempted. In fact, the plaintiffs essentially concede in their discussion of Ray that if the rule had been written, use cleaner fuel or meet an alternative method of equivalent emissions, that under Ray, this court would be compelled to uphold the rule. In effect, that's essentially what the rule does. It has no benchmark within it other than the use of clean fuels.
But the benchmark has to be the emission standards. Otherwise, we can't know whether or not the alternative fuel is cleaner or not.
No, because we know that the standard set for the fuel is 5,000 parts per million. Any vessel, regardless of how dirty the engine may be, if it uses the fuel that has 5,000 parts per million, it complies.
Even though the ultimate emission level may be higher than 5,000 parts per million.
Well, it won't be higher than 5,000 parts per million in the fuel, but the number of particles emitted into
coming
the air
the smoke,
may be very different.
Right.
That's correct. And that's an essential distinction that EPA has stated between an in-use limitation and an emission standard. The emission standard can be met only by modifying the equipment. An in-use limitation or sulfur requirement is met by changing how the equipment is used, i.e. the use of different fuel within that equipment. I'd like to address the question of the different states and whether they would adopt different standards. First, the court and the district court is falling into the trap of engrafting onto the Clean Air Act a Commerce Clause argument, but making it more difficult for us to regulate than under a Commerce Clause argument. In the Huron-Portland cement case, decided by the U.S. Supreme Court upholding the applicability of air pollution regulations in Detroit, the court said that in the absence of any conflicting statutes or state requirements in the record, it would not entertain a Commerce Clause claim based upon conflicts. And in this record, in fact, not only is there no indication of conflict, in our record there is a PMSA website which indicates that in Tacoma, Seattle, Puget Sound area, there is in fact voluntary compliance by up to 50% of the vessels with low sulfur fuel, albeit there are no requirements in that area. So the specter of
but
a patchwork.
But is that because of the fact that PMSA ships are calling at ports all over the North American continent, indeed all over the world for that matter? So if you're going to have a vessel that's operating, if it's got to comply with California's regulations, then it's probably going to be burning the same fuel whether it's calling at Long Beach and then moving on to Seattle and then on to Vancouver, British Columbia. Doesn't make any difference to a container ship, right?
Well, it doesn't have to because it actually contains generally two fuel tanks, one for the dirtier bunker fuel, which it uses on the path over from Asia, and one for the cleaner fuel, which it uses as
it
approaches.
So they can switch back and forth is what you're saying?
They can switch, yes. But finally, I would like to reiterate that Section 211 of the Clean Air Act is where the court established preemptions for states adopting fuel regulations. In that section, there is no preemption for fuel regulations for non-road engines. And in fact, we have, as cited in CARB's brief, EPA stating that fuel switching near ports is a viable strategy for state governments, just as we've done here. I'd be happy to answer any questions of the court.
I guess not, Ms. Baird. Thank you very much.
Good morning.
Why don't you hang on a second while we
sure.
Let the people out of the cheap seats here. Arden, is the clock working at all? How much time does counsel have on the clock?
I have 20 minutes, Your Honor.
The hour clock is malfunctioning here. That's why I'm asking. So I'm trying to keep time.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Eric Wise, Flynn Delich and Wise, representing Pacific Merchant Shipping Association, the appellee in this case. I want to start by reiterating that within its territorial boundaries, there is no dispute in this case that California can adopt and enforce the standards set by Section E1 of the regulations, but must, the only point of this case on the Clean Air Act issue is do they have to go to the EPA to do so, and that's our point.
Do you agree with Mr. Stern that if they just worded this a little differently, we wouldn't have this problem?
I think, Your Honor, I think if they had said that you must use low sulfur fuel, then the issue would be the one that was not reached or really addressed by the facts below. That is, does it require, would it require modification of the ship's engines? And in this case, I think at least the preliminary evidence below is that at least for some of the ships, it does require modification of the tanks and piping in order that the ship can have two tanks. And under the definition of...
but that's a modification to the vessel, but not to the engine, right?
Well...
That's just a question of fuel supply.
No, Your Honor. It's because of the fact that contrary or differently than motor vehicle definition of the engine, a non-road engine is defined to include the fuel system on the ships. So that is a definition of non-road engine that would encompass the modifications that
but
have
otherwise
to be made.
The engine can handle the low sulfur fuel and switch from the more polluting bunker oil to the cleaner low sulfur fuel other than piping modification.
I think we conceded that below.
So leaving aside any specter of ship modification, if Congress had in mind that one of the ways of having a fuel requirement would be to have a specific sulfur requirement, and if, as State has argued, that what you have here really is precisely that, a fuel requirement with a specific sulfur content, why then isn't that a fuel requirement that meets the in-use rules under Section D?
Well, because of the way that they framed the regulation, Your Honor, and that is that they framed it as a standard, as an emission standard. That is, not an exceedance, an emissions level for each of the specific pollutants. I think that's an important element here, which is that the NOx, SOx, and particulate matter are specified as pollutants.
That's that chart that we keep seeing?
Yes, Your Honor. But I think that in the case law, and I'm thinking particularly of the MA case, 627 F second, the Adamo case, the EMA versus EPA case, and of course EMA versus South Coast AQMD, the point is that if you set an emissions level that the engine must meet, and it relates to specific pollutants, and as does this regulation identify specific pollutants as those which are subject to the limitation, that is a standard within the meaning of both of all of the 209 provisions. And that's really the point here, which is that they did not adopt a fuel use standard, and they adopted a emissions standard, which is preempted by Section 209 E2A of the statute.
What is your response to their argument on Ray, that when you're looking at alternatives, that in effect Ray would save them from any other infirmity that might inure in their wording of this particular regulation?
Well, I think first of all, alternatives really have nothing to do with our argument. But more importantly, I think they misread Ray. In Ray, what you had was a design requirement, which the court said, standing alone, was invalid. The state could not enforce that regulation, and that's what the case held. It went on to say that the alternative, which was the tug escort, was enforceable, and merely because they could also comply with that requirement by having voluntarily meeting the design requirements, that did not invalidate the valid tug and escort rule. But the point of Ray was that they invalidated the design requirements, which the analysis by the state and by the interveners does not face up to. And here, by analogy, Section E1, which is the emissions level provision, must be invalidated on its face because it's a on its face, it sets an emission standard. In this case, however, unlike the Ray case, if Section E1 is in fact invalidated and it cannot be enforced, there is no alternative requirement. In other words, the Section E1C is merely a presumption that there is a compliance with E1, and because of that, if the court, as it should, were to invalidate E1, the standard of E1 as preempted, there is no alternative which would otherwise be satisfactory.
Go back to what you started with. You said alternatives don't really have anything to do with our argument. And as I hear them, alternatives have everything to do with their argument. So where's the intersection?
The intersection is, Your Honor, that the alternatives are set forth in G. Each one of those alternatives, however, must satisfy the standard of E1. That's unlike the tug and escort provision in Ray.
Were they kind of independent?
Whether they were independent, yes. And so if E1 is invalidated as an emissions level standard, then then there is nothing left for as an alternative which can be enforced. And this is the way the rule is drafted. We didn't draft this rule. It was drafted by CARB, and for whatever reason, I suspect that the principal reason for the drafting of this was not flexibility, because they could have had a fuel use standard which also had flexibility, which also had the alternatives of G, but was still a fuel use, a pure fuel use standard. They didn't do that. I think the reason that they didn't do that was because underlying Locke is a fundamental point, which is that states cannot regulate the shipping industry, the internal workings on the ship, and they were concerned about that. So what they did was they set a performance standard, which now they come to the, which they, had we challenged this as a rule which regulated the internal workings of the ship, they would have said, no, it's a standard emissions level that can be met by any measure whatsoever. So that what they did was they drafted this rule to set an emissions level standard, but didn't go to the EPA. And that's all we're asking for. Go to the EPA, make it a national standard so that we don't have...
Of course, if they don't have to go, they don't have to go.
Well, that's true.
You know, that takes me to all-way taxi.
Yes.
All-way taxi, City of New York says taxis have to use certain kinds of fuels and they have to have emission devices that regulate the amount of emissions. That was upheld by the Second Circuit.
Right.
How is our case different?
Well, first of all, it was a motor vehicle case, and so that our case involves used engines.
Okay, besides the fact that one's a taxi and one's a boat.
Right, right. Okay. No, but I think the point is one was a motor vehicle, which is governed by 209B, and the other, in this case, is 209E, which is, I think it's been conceded at this point, is does apply to used engines, so that the point of all-way taxi for this case, which is that they apply to used engines, which is that you look to the issue of whether or not it has an effect on interstate commerce as part of the statutory analysis. This isn't a constitutional commerce clause analysis. This is a statutory analysis which is incorporated into the standard requirements that are set forth in 209E2, and because it is these are used engines, it applies to used engines, the issue of whether the all-way taxi case, or the issue of its relation back to the its relation back to the manufacturers does not apply. And in fact, if it had been ships instead of taxis, then the all-way taxi would have been decided differently. The point about all-way taxi is because the statute only relates to new motor vehicles, and these regulations did not relate back, that was why the court found that those were permissible.
I understood your argument to be that hallway taxi was, I'm over generalizing, was basically a local regulation as opposed to these marine vessels which purport to regulate maritime vessels that go all over the world.
That's true. That's part of our argument. But I think that it's really a twofold argument. One is that that gets to the second part of the analysis, which is that it applies to, that they are applying this rule to, and it has a substantial effect on interstate commerce. They say that doesn't because it's just a local rule, but these ships are, it first of all goes out to 24 miles, which in itself I think makes it not a localized rule.
Second, no, these engines are the auxiliary engines, right?
That's true.
These are the ones that run while they're still in port that power the ship while they're there at the dock.
Well, they do that.
Okay. Yes,
but they also...
Right, I know, but just by way of preface to the question, if these rules were confined to just what happened in port, would that change the result?
No, Your Honor, I don't think so, because we still would be in it still has an effect on interstate commerce, which is that the ships, in order to comply, the ships have to purchase the fuel in China, Korea, Japan, and all, before they get to the port. In other words, this is not a regulation which affects only their conduct within there. It affects their conduct all the way to the port departure.
How do you distinguish Huron Portland Cement?
Well, there are two things. First, I think Huron Portland Cement was a case that, had it been decided today, would have required EPA approval. That's the first point, because as the case states, there were questions of whether, I mean, in order to comply with the smoke standards, there had to be modifications to the ships, and that's stated right in the opinion. So first of all, that case was not a Clean Air Act case. That case was specifically a case before the Clean Air Act, and the regulation that was considered in that case had to do with the boiler standards, and the court said, well, they can still say you can't emit smoke. Here, what we have now is that is a Clean Air Act, which stretches out to the non-road engines, to the ship's engines, and I would submit that Port Huron would be decided differently under the Clean Air Act than under the Boiler Act, and that's the distinction I think it's important here. But more importantly, I think, is that on the, well, not more importantly, but with respect to the second part of our argument, which is that outside 3 miles, of course, Port Huron was restricted to when the ships were in fact alongside the dock and therefore did not reach the 3 mile limit. Let me just say briefly about the Section 211 provisions. They have nothing to do with this case either. Those fuel specification regulations preempt certain states, not including California, from regulating the specifications, the additives that are used in fuel that is sold in the market, and with respect to new motor vehicles only, it's the principal thrust of that statute is to regulate the sale, manufacture of fuel within the state, which is not at issue here. But more importantly, they're arguing from a negative point of view, that is, because it says nothing about fuel use and doesn't preempt fuel use requirements, that somehow means that they can regulate and adopt the emission standard that's in this case. It doesn't change the analysis. The emission standard in this case is one which sets an emission level and is therefore within the EMA versus the AQMD point. And finally, I would say that on the Chevron deference and the issue of the EPA's views on this, what they're trying to say is that because the because the EPA has allowed fuel use regulations, somehow this is a fuel use regulation. We don't even get to the EPA and Chevron deference in this case because the EPA has not, in fact, said anything about this kind of regulation and whether or not it is a use or fuel use standard. And unless the court has further questions, I would
thank you, Mr. White. Mr. Stern, I think you reserved 2 minutes.
Thank you.
I'm going to make sure we have 2 minutes on the clock, because as I say, we can't see.
On the very last point that Mr. Wise made, EPA has commented about state fuel regulations. One time in its response to comments when it issued its 1999 regulations for ocean-going vessels, it actually said in its response, and this is cited in the brief, that states are in a position to regulate the fuel used by ocean-going vessels. More recently, twice in 2007 in its regulations, and again, I've cited to these in the brief, they have cited with approval California's actions generally with regard to reducing pollutions at ports and in around the port areas. As part of that plan that they cite to, the VESTA rules are in that plan. I'd also like to mention that it is actually undisputed in this case that the vessels and the same vessels and the same engines can be used to comply with the VESTA rules. No modifications, no retrofits, no design change.
Well, how do you respond to Mr. Weiss's argument that that's not necessarily so with regard to piping certain fuel lines and so on, that that's considered part of a non-motor vehicle engine?
I respond that the evidence in the record is contrary to that. The only evidence there is in the record is that in response to CARB surveys, some vessel owners have responded that they needed to make changes to the piping, that sort of thing. That's a far cry from saying that those were actually required. Those are not just de minimis changes. Those may just be maintenance. But in the record in this case, it is undisputed, PMSA admitted, that no changes need be made.
In the engine itself?
In the engine, which PMSA claims to include the piping and fuel pumps and that sort of thing.
Looks like your time is up.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Baird, thank you. Mr. Weiss, thank you as well. The case just argued is submitted. We're going to stand in recess. Now, ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like, I think the law clerks are going to be hanging around. If you want to chat with them, and after we go back and finish our conference, we'll be out to chat with you if you'd like as well. Thank you. Stand in recess.